But first, the Shapiroet as promised. Now is the winter of discontent, and we cross to Bruce, who must be feeling the chill.
I am looking out my window on a dark New Haven, Connecticut street on which an inch or so of snow has just fallen. It's the picture of a beautiful, crisp New England winter morning.
The trouble with snow is it hides the truth as well as anything else. So let's get stuck into it. We were talking to Joshua Yaffa in Moscow the other day about, America teetering on the brink with Putin and Ukraine. Would you like to do a riff on that? Because it's been a bit of a problem for Joe.
It certainly has. It's a problem for Joe as it is a problem for the world. Part of my brain keeps going back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the famous description at the end of that confrontation between the Soviet Union and the U.S. We were eyeball to eyeball and the other guy blinked. We're at the eyeball to eyeball part and waiting to see if there's any blinking involved. For Joe, this has been a complicated moment. First of all, it's striking that Ukraine is bedeviling the Trump presidency, the Biden presidency, just as it bedeviled Trump. In Trump's case, it was the constant stream of corrupt political money, Paul Manafort, all of that sort of Trump scandal stuff that had to do with Russia-aligned Ukrainian money and oligarchs, and now it's the proposed Russian invasion of Ukraine. Ukraine has become this kind of giant gray zone, on the one hand leaning toward Europe in its overt politics, and on the other hand a kind of Wild West graft economy that has served Russia's interests very well. And Russia's been invading Ukraine for a long time. People forget this in the form of oligarchs, of Russia-oriented political parties that have sometimes captured political power, of graft, of assassinations, of hackers. The tanks now on the border just to the north of Kiev are only the latest manifestation of this ongoing struggle that goes back, to the Orange Revolution in 2004, 2005, and before, to NATO's decision to expand its borders eastward. And Biden seems to recognize the complicated reality, and he's having an argument with himself that's playing out in public. On the one hand, at his press conference last week, he seemed to accept as an inevitability the idea that Putin is going to reclaim some Ukrainian territory. And he seemed almost ready to accept it. He did one of those uncensored Joe moments and said Putin's got to go in.
Bruce, that was regarded as so inept that many, and not just on the right, were wondering about his mental competence.
Well, I would view it as a classic Joe Biden 1.0 uncensored moment. This is the kind of thing that Biden has always done. The Biden blurt is one of his consistent problems. In this case, it reflects what is clearly a stream of policy thinking going on behind closed doors, even while, just as Putin is doing his shadow play with tanks and so on, now Biden has come out and said, okay, we're going to put 8,500 troops on alert. It's the political math here is very complicated. No one really thinks that Ukraine, whose political system is still mired in corruption and where oligarchs behind the scenes, some aligned with Russia, some Ukrainian nationalists, are still running a lot of the show. No one really thinks that the U.S. or NATO should go to the edge of nuclear war over Ukraine. And at the same time, it's clear that Ukraine is this buffer zone between the democratic aspirations of Eastern Europe and Ukraine itself and Russia's desire to have a way of extending its influence into Europe. It's a very complicated problem.
I made the Cuban Missile Crisis parallel when I was talking to Joshua Yaffa. And I would remind us that, in fact, Putin's got cause for concern because Ukraine is becoming, by osmosis, if not, you know, effectively, a NATO member. No wonder he's worried.
Well, whether or not it's becoming a NATO member, certainly its civil society is becoming more Western-oriented in big parts of the country. Look, it's still an ethnically divided country. It is still a country with an East that is still closely aligned with Russia. But you've got an anti-corruption movement in politics, which may be the most important reason, by the way, that Putin wants to invade. It's that he can't control the political system. And remember that the Ukrainians themselves have now twice rejected Russia-friendly governments, first in the Orange Revolution in 2004-2005, and then in the Maidan Uprising. And indeed, the former palace of the last Russia-oriented president, Yanukovych, is now a museum to graft. You can go onto the grounds there just outside of Kiev and see all of the tacky furniture. It's the perfect Trumpian landscape, actually. All of the absurd investments in terrible art and suits of armor and all those of that the former president of the country and his cronies invested in. You know, I think for all of the talk of armed insurgency and should the U.S. be arming Kiev even more than it is, if Russia were to roll its tanks down the road on the hard, frozen ground in the next couple of weeks, the most important thing they will face, actually, and this is being neglected, I think, in a lot of the conversation, both in Washington and in Europe, is civil resistance from a Ukrainian population that has already evicted Russia from Ukrainian politics twice. And that's a dynamic that's being forgotten. It's a little frustrating as someone who has spent some time in Ukraine and has friends, especially among Ukrainian journalists, to see the Ukrainians themselves being almost invisible in the negotiations and invisible political footballs in this battle of wills. Within Washington, the battle of wills is between those who, within the Biden administration, who want a hard military confrontation, who believe that we need to be just containing Russia, period, the sort of new cold warriors. And on the other hand, I suspect from his words, Biden himself and others who recognize that while Ukraine may become an Afghanistan for Russia, it could also become a Vietnam for the U.S., and that this is the stakes in restarting nuclear arms talks and in other things are actually pretty high here. The gas pipelines to Europe, all this sort of thing, create some very complex realities that the very black and white eyeball-to-eyeball rhetoric that we are getting between Russia and the U.S. in public doesn't really reflect.
We've just entered the second year of Joe's presidency, Bruce, and he suffered a devastating defeat over voters' rights. Take us through that.
Well, indeed. It hasn't really been a great month for Joe Biden. Right after the new year, he went out of the block into 2022 in rip-roaring fashion, doing a speaking tour through Georgia and other parts of the country, really championing his voting rights bill, the Democrats' voting rights bill in the Senate that was designed to push back against Republican chipping away in various venues at the civil rights movement. And that seemed to be an exciting moment, but it fizzled so quickly, thanks largely, of course, to the two reluctant Democratic senators, Kristen Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who said they would not vote against the filibuster in order to allow this bill to move forward. Thanks even more so, of course, to unified Republican opposition, even Republicans who have sometimes supported civil rights bills in the past decided to keep their ranks together on this one. And it raised the interesting question, why would Biden and why would Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plunge ahead with this voting rights bill when they were really just staging their own defeat? And I think to that, you have to look at the dynamics of this year. It is, of course, we're headed into the midterm elections. And key Democratic constituencies, in particular, African-American communities, black voters, who have been promised much by Biden, have not gotten a whole lot thanks to the fractious politics of Washington. And I think in symbolic terms, Biden and Schumer wanted to show themselves as fighters on this issue. And at the same time, there is a real threat around the country in legislature after legislature at the state level. Republicans are, conservative Trump-aligned Republicans, are stepping up to fill local voting voting administrator jobs, whether it's as secretaries of state, running for local municipal offices. They want to control who counts the votes, and they're passing legislation in state legislatures to make it a little bit harder to vote. This voting rights are a central issue in this election year. It was an interesting bit of politics to stage a defeat just to keep the issue alive.
It is said that Joe's going very badly in the polls. If we compare his polling at this point to previous presidents, how bad is it?
Well, this one, I think, is overstated. You know, it is true that Biden is in the tank in the last couple of polls, well below 50%. And the enthusiasm level, particularly among core Democratic constituencies, has really fallen off as he's been unable to deliver in this toxic Washington environment. But, you know, you can look to Ronald Reagan at the end of the first year of his presidency, you know, a very different president, obviously, and politically. And that man, who went on to win two terms, was also in the tank at the end of the first term. I don't think the polls 1 year into a four-year presidency are prophecy. What they do reflect is the challenges that this still young administration faces. The difference between the Reagan period and now is that, of course, Congress is so much more profoundly divided, so unable to compromise on anything or pass any legislation across ideological lines. Biden can claim his infrastructure bill. He can claim his COVID relief, but with inflation running at a scary level, with this confrontation with Russia, with voting rights being chipped away, and with the Supreme Court not only looking anew at Roe versus Wade, but now, as of yesterday, taking on for reconsideration affirmative action in college admissions, it really looks as if a lot of the gains of the last 50 years or so in American politics are up for grabs in the next 3 years.
And well, Bruce, Biden is under attack not only from his right wingers, but also, probably more seriously, from his left.
Well, and that was to be expected, right? Biden is not Bernie Sanders. He has historically been a moderate on most issues. The big concern he has, the biggest concern he has, is black communities, African-American politicians like James Clyburn, who so crucially championed him the first time out, if their enthusiasm is diminishing, if their belief in Biden's ability to deliver is collapsing, the ability of the White House to pull out, eke through a congressional majority this year to succeed in a re-election term, in another 2 years, that is that then becomes up in the air. So those are the things that Biden is most worried about. Look, he's in a tough position. Washington politics are in a tough position. A year ago, when you and I spoke, he seemed to be promising almost a revived New Deal, a real rethinking of the American social contract, and finally a pushback against the Reagan-era notion of the market that dominated Republican and Democratic politics alike. He seemed to be talking about something else. That expansive vision is off the table for now, and we're in a kind of rear guard action to protect voting rights and civil rights and abortion rights, on and on.
Let's cheer ourselves up by talking about Tina Fey's doppelganger Sarah Palin.
There's a wonderful, wonderful lawsuit that's about to be heard in a New York courtroom. Would have been heard this week, except anti-vax Sarah came down with COVID-19. Some cases have been delayed. A few years ago, the New York Times ran an editorial about gun rights in which it said that Sarah Palin had published a map putting Representative Gabby Giffords in crosshairs for her pro-gun stance prior to the mass shooting in which she was a victim. There was a factual error in that. It was a picture of her election district, not a picture of Giffords herself. The Times corrected the error. Palin has now sued for libel. And, you know, this would be, on the one hand, a kind of fun chance to watch the right and the New York Times just tearing each other apart. They're favorite enemies of one another. It actually matters, though, because a few of the current crop of conservative Supreme Court justices actually have sounded friendly to making it easier for politicians like Sarah Palin to sue journalists for libel. In the U.S., ever since 1963, another case involving the New York Times, public figures have had a very, very high bar to overcome to prevail in any libel suit. And while this case, on the one hand, seems absurd, it's an honest mistake, it was corrected, and all this sort of thing, we've got a legal right wing. People like Clarence Thomas and others are now keen to make it easier for politicians to sue journalists for libel. So this case actually does have some press freedom alarms going, and it's really worth watching.
And, of course, Donald Trump would be delighted by it because he was pushing to change the arrangements in regard to libel.
Very much. And, of course, Palin in many ways is the great predecessor of Donald Trump. She was, when she was John McCain's vice presidential candidate, she really became the champion of the nativist, anti-intellectual politics that Trump then cloaked himself in a few years later.
Bruce, so, we all remember Sarah. Look, thanks for that. The first Shapiroette for the year. Bruce Shapiro, Executive Director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University.